Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present a report on the protests that greeted corporate leaders and their political allies as they gathered in New York City for the World Economic Forum, John Cavanna of the Institute for Policy Studies, who describes what happened at the second annual World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, where thousands of international social justice activists and academics met to discuss alternative development models. And Deborah Peebles of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, who discusses the continuing struggle to free the Native American activists that many around the world believe to be a political prisoner, unjustly convicted of murder. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Israel's aggressive use of military force in the occupied Palestinian territories has created a major split in the Israeli army over a pledge by 100 reserve officers not to serve in Palestinian zones. The reservists publicly object to the military tactics used to crush the Palestinian uprising and have signed a petition, published in Israeli newspapers, that states the government posture towards the Palestinians is dominating, expelling, starving, and humiliating an entire people. According to the BBC, the campaign of military resistance has won the backing of Ami Ayalon, the former head of Israel's Internal Security Service. Speaking on Israeli television, Ayalon declared that not enough soldiers are refusing to follow what he calls blatantly illegal orders in the occupied territories, and that too many Palestinian youth are being shot by Israeli soldiers. The friction in the Israeli army has gotten so bad that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Army Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Shaul Mofaz have blasted the resistors as undemocratic and seeking an incitement to rebellion. Petition organizer Yaniv Itzovich told a leading Israeli paper that you can't be both an occupier and moral. Zionism is not occupation. On January 31st, the Bush administration said it wanted states to classify a fetus as an unborn child so low-income women would qualify for prenatal care. The change would make a fetus eligible for health care under the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, that currently provides health care coverage to qualifying low-income children under the age of 19. But the reaction from the National Organization for Women President Kim Gandhi was swift. She stated that George W. Bush has taken yet another step toward reversing a woman's right to abortion under Roe v. Wade. This is a transparent ploy to grant legal personhood to embryos and fetuses. Gandhi said Bush has made his agenda quite clear in recent weeks by declaring January 20th National Sanctity of Human Life Day. Bush said unborn children should be welcomed in life and protected in law. Now has challenged the White House and Bush supporters in Congress to mandate health coverage for low-income pregnant women. Gandhi noted that President Bush's budget last year sought to cut the maternal and child health care block grants that provide health care to women before, during, and after pregnancy, and to freeze the Healthy Start program, which has been shown to reduce infant mortality and morbidity. Administration officials deny that abortion politics are a factor in their decision, but that states would be able to expand eligibility and utilize more CHIP funds that last year had to be returned. Gandhi concluded that endowing a fetus with more rights than a pregnant woman is a slap in the face to women everywhere. One of the most severe cases of repression of civil liberties in recent months has come out of liberal San Francisco. There, two dissident AIDS activists, Michael Petrelis and David Pasquarelli, have been charged with felonies for engaging in abusive phone calls and labeled terrorists. Both activists have AIDS and are unable to pay the $500,000 for bail and remain behind bars. They face 27 charges, including stalking, terrorist threats, and conspiracy. They face a maximum penalty of 78 years in jail. The charges result from a series of late-night phone calls that the duo made to reporters and editors at the San Francisco Chronicle. The pair complained that people with AIDS would be abused by a new health initiative from the Bush administration that would permit a quarantine for any infectious disease that can be transmitted from person to person, a definition so broad as to include all transmission of HIV. According to the news magazine In These Times, many leading gays object to the felony charges against Petrelis and Pasquarelli as a move to squash political dissent. Activists are calling for a reduction of the $500,000 in bail, calling it the equivalent of preventive detention. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Over 2,500 of the planet's wealthiest and most powerful people converged on the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City for 5 days beginning January 31st. Groups from around the world opposed to corporate-led globalization, free trade, and neoliberal economic policies also came to New York. Weeks in advance of the event, both the police and the media had loudly warned against violent protesters coming to the city, justifying the deployment of 4,000 officers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris was in New York and filed this report.
Environmental, labor, and student groups organized conferences, protests, and street theater in New York to greet the elite delegates on the theme of Another World is Possible, and they are all Enron, we are all Argentina. The AFL-CIO convened a Working Families Economic Forum just blocks from the Waldorf, where workers from around the globe described layoffs and workplace abuse, which they blamed on corporate globalization. Sofia Sazo, a Guatemalan garment worker who made clothes for the Gap store, recounted through a translator the harsh conditions at the factory, which motivated her to fight for a union.
When we came into work in the morning, they searched us. And the search was even harder, even more thorough when we left. It was humiliating. They touched us all over our bodies. But one has to work. And that's why I'm here today, to help my compañeras, my fellow workers, have a dignified work, and to remember that all of us are human beings.
AFL-CIO President John Sweeney told an audience of more than 400 why so many had come to protest decisions being made by business leaders at the World Economic Forum.
The global economy does not work for working people, and that is why we are here in New York, to challenge Enron economics at home and abroad. We have to change the rules that were made by and for corporations, and it will be no easy or short-term task. So we are here to strengthen and deepen the spirit and solidarity that were born in Seattle and change the direction of the debate over globalization. We are here to up the ante in the fight to include workers' rights and human rights and a livable environment in every trade agreement, and to make them a part of the fiber of every world financial institution. We're here to bring pressure on governments in the United States and around the world to make new rules and to enforce those rules. We're here to add meaning and clarity to our message and to make education of consumers and taxpayers, workers and elected officials a priority.
On Saturday, February 2nd, a crowd estimated by organizers at between 25 and 30,000 marched through the streets of Manhattan, singing, beating drums, and hoisting brightly colored puppets in opposition to the WEF agenda. Mateo was part of a radical cheerleading squad dubbed the Haymarket Hussies.
In my opinion, we won the day we all got here. We won the day we invented radical cheerleading, artistic revolution, because it's about a lot more than just who's controlling the physical world. It's about who's controlling the philosophical world, who's controlling the artistic world, and that's us.
Some 30 demonstrators were arrested during the mostly peaceful day as police tightly controlled all aspects of the march. Becca Economopoulos, an organizer with Another World is Possible Coalition, assessed the largest action of the weekend.
I think today was wonderful success. We had probably about 30,000 people in the streets, people of conscience, willing to take a stand and make their voices heard, to advocate for a different world, a better world.
How was the cooperation by the New York City Police Department here?
I'm happy that the New York City Police Department didn't crack skulls. I've seen them in the past definitely escalate conflict. I think it's unfortunate that they made it difficult for us to peacefully assemble by fracturing the crowd in so many places, by blocking us off and separating our numbers. But nonetheless, I think that we were wildly effective at making the folks inside the World Economic Forum very aware that there is dissent, that people are not happy about what they're talking about inside and believe that there's other ways to craft a global economy that's more just and more sustainable.
For weeks before the World Economic Forum, the mainstream commercial press has been talking about violence and conflict. But what is your view of how the press sort of sensationalized this whole thing? Did that help or hurt you guys?
I think the media's hoopla around and sensationalizing violence and the clash between protesters and police is something that we see at virtually every mobilization. This one was particularly inflammatory, and I feel like it probably scared a lot of people away from joining us, a lot of people who agree with our message, a lot of people who would be happy to come out to say, as New Yorkers, as so many folks of us have lost our jobs recently, who are faced with a global recession and its impacts, we now more than ever need to be taking to the streets to make our voices heard.
Several smaller but more militant actions followed on Sunday, February 3rd. The anti-capitalist convergence organized a snake march through Greenwich Village, but were quickly set upon by police with nightsticks and pepper spray, resulting in several injuries. Later in the day, the Coalition for Earth and Animal Liberation paraded through the streets of the Upper East Side. Several demonstrators targeted an apartment building where windows were smashed and red paint was splattered on the entryway. The total number arrested over 5 days in New York was just over 200. While the World Economic Forum adopted much of the rhetoric of social justice during their meetings, most activists were skeptical that words would turn into deeds in addressing the growing inequality of the global economy. And it seems that no matter where institutions like the Forum may go to hold their meetings in the future, the global social justice movement will be there too to shine a light on the dark side of corporate-led globalization. For Between the Lines, this is Scott Harris.
While the corporate elite, political leaders, protesters, and police competed for attention and control of the cold streets of New York during the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum, social justice activists from around the globe converged on Porto Alegre, Brazil, for the World Social Forum. Designed to offer an alternative to the Economic Forum's market-driven vision for the world, the Social Forum drew more than 40,000 this year from Europe, Asia, Africa, Latin, and North America. Luminaries of the left, such as social critic Noam Chomsky and José Bové, the French farmer whose acts of civil disobedience against McDonald's won him international folk hero status, were among the thousands of activists, academics, workers, and students representing the growing global social justice movement there. Hundreds of workshops, meetings, and plenary sessions were held in Porto Alegre to explore alternative models for economic and environmentally sustainable development. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Cavanna, director of the Institute for Policy Studies, who attended the World Social Forum and discusses the deliberations and action plans that came out of the Porto Alegre gathering.
After September 11th, part of the importance of this meeting was simply to say this movement, this anti-corporate globalization movement, this global justice movement, is alive, it's strong, it's regaining momentum. And I would say that came through very strong, and the two catalytic events, which I think people feel have changed the momentum back towards us after September 11th, in a sense, changed the subject globally from the issues we were concerned with, sweatshop workers, climate change, and so on, shifted them to this U.S. war against terrorism. But in the last 6 weeks, both the collapse of the Argentinian economy. Argentina is a country which followed completely the precepts of this global elite, and in particular the International Monetary Fund told them to open up their markets, free their markets, and they were caught in a collapse that was rooted in those free market policies. That has dealt a severe blow to the credibility of these elite forces. And then second is the Enron scandal, which in a sense sums up everything that's wrong with a world where global corporations have too much power. So the first part of the importance of Porto Alegre is regaining the momentum of this movement. And I think that's been achieved with the help of these two tragic events, tragic for so many people, but events, both Argentina and Enron, which state clearly that the status quo model of going forward is deeply, deeply flawed. In terms of our goal of putting forward concrete alternatives, there were over 1,000 different sessions at this meeting in Porto Alegre, all of them focused in one way or another on alternatives. And they go everywhere from the very practical proposals for how you can create alternative transportation, energy, agriculture, and manufacturing systems that are more rooted locally that serve people better, that are better for the environment and therefore the climate. So all the way from those very concrete sorts of proposals to proposals such as Porto Alegre's own experience of how you can increase democracy at local and regional levels, all the way up to very interesting proposals for how you could replace these giant global public institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, which have become so dysfunctional and which so undermine democracy, how you could continue the process of taking legitimacy away from them and put entities in their place that would safeguard people's needs and people's rights and the health of the planet.
Having just come back, I'm sure quite energized by all the like-minded folks who gathered in Porto Alegre, do you have any sense of where the international social justice movement will go next?
There was a feeling that there is, for the first time in really 2.5 decades, an opening for a real movement to press for new checks and balances on corporations. Enron exposes to everyone the corruption of our politics as well as the inadequate checks and balances on global corporations. And so everyone at this meeting is committed to using Enron as a terrific teachable moment and a moment where we can, again, in each of our respective countries, press for more meaningful corporate reforms. So that's one track. The second is that we feel over the past 5 or 6 years we have pointed out to people the great flaws of these big public institutions, the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization, that these are institutions, whatever merit they may have had when they were set up, and the World Bank and IMF were set up right after World War II, their agendas have been twisted by the interests of large corporations, and we need to continue the process of showing how illegitimate they are and proposing alternatives. And in the meantime, before we get to the alternatives, pressing them, like the World Bank, to shift their policies of lending 25 times more for polluting fossil fuels than what they give to renewables, to flipping that ratio on its head. So a second track will focus on those institutions which have been the subject of the giant global protests. We think we've got those institutions right now on the defensive, and we want to keep that up. And then finally, the third is to much more practically put forward alternatives local and national levels. We can't wait for this whole system to come tumbling down to press hard for much more sustainable alternatives that are much more respectful of basic worker rights at the local and state and national level. A lot of these sorts of experiments are going on, and the more we share them, the more we can learn from one another and, again, create a momentum of moving away from this period that really began with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher 20 years ago of glorifying the free market and pushing for deregulation. We're now at a moment, again, partly thanks to Enron and the collapse of Argentina, where people, by and large, think governments have a strong role to play. They think that corporations have too much power, and it's a moment to build real alternatives for a better world. And that's a lot of what was going on at this World Social Forum in Brazil.
That was John Cavanna, Director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. The World Social Forum website can be accessed at www.worldsocialforum.org. On February 6, 1976, Native American activist Leonard Peltier was arrested in Canada and charged with murdering two FBI agents the previous June on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. Beginning with extradition hearings marked by perjured testimony, Peltier's entire legal odyssey has been riddled with injustice. He eventually was convicted of the murders, received two consecutive life sentences, and has just completed his 26th year in Leavenworth Penitentiary in Kansas. Many individuals and organizations around the world consider Peltier to be a political prisoner, including Amnesty International, which has called for his immediate release. Peltier's defense committee and supporters pushed hard in 2000 to win clemency from outgoing President Bill Clinton. Clinton's failure to act was a huge blow to the movement to free Peltier, but in the years since, the defense committee has reorganized, added members, and is pursuing new initiatives. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Deborah Peebles, who has worked on Peltier's behalf for many years. She recently joined the reinvigorated effort to free him from prison and talked about the new initiatives now being undertaken.
One thing with clemency is that you cannot have any cases in court. So for at least a year, there were no cases in court on behalf of Peltier. This year, we thought, well, the Bush administration doesn't really look like they're going to be a pardoning administration, but we thought this is a good year to take chances with the court system. And so we have gone to court with three different cases. One of the cases that really was important for us was a civil suit against the FBI, because during the clemency campaign, the FBI really came out in force with misinformation, disinformation, putting out stuff that really wasn't true about the Peltier case. And although all along the past 26, 27 years since this event took place with Peltier at Oglala, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, they've always lied, and now it really seemed they had such a big part in the denial of clemency, coming out and demonstrating, even the FBI demonstrated against it, that it really was time to take them on and say, fight a fair battle, and we want honesty with this battle, and not just throwing out a lot of slurs and misinformation, but let's fight a fair fight. And they really don't have information, but they do make up a lot of it. So we had to go to civil court, and that is one of the cases that's going to court. Already filed are two other cases, the first one being something to reduce or to re-examine his sentence, Peltier's sentence. He was sentenced to two consecutive life terms. And under what's called Rule 35, we have an opportunity to re-examine that actually he probably should have only gotten one life sentence. So, and if that's the case, then he would be up for parole. And then the second case that's already been filed is a Freedom of Information Act case, and we're hearing a lot about that today because of terrorist acts. Our Attorney General, Ashcroft, does not want to release any papers the FBI has. We're not the only people up to get the Freedom of Information Act papers and on different lawsuits or different cases the FBI have taken on. So it's going to be a tough struggle. Back in 1981, we had a case of Freedom of Information, or FOIA as it's called, case against the FBI and won it. But they only released half the documents, and we want the other half. And even the one in 1981 is very important because it disclosed the ballistics test that proved that they knew Peltier's gun did not shoot the agents. The bullets did not match his gun. But in court, in the court case, the original court case, the testimony in court was just the opposite, and that they really kind of muddied the whole testimony on the ballistics test. And then 1981, when we got the paperwork, it showed they actually knew the bullets didn't come from his gun. So they're really important papers, and for some reason, and I'm sure very important reasons, they did not want to release the rest of the papers. They released about 6,000 in the 1981 case, and we believe there's about 6,000 more to be released, or should be released.
Besides the legal cases, there's also a big push on now for public actions, isn't there, around the country, having people in different places hold events to commemorate the beginning of Peltier's 27th year in prison on
right.
February 6th?
Internationally, there are events going on all over the world, rallies, awareness demonstrations. Some people are playing the Robert Redford movie, Incident at Oglala, rallies. In fact, it more or less kicked off in Moscow, Russia, yesterday with a rally in Moscow, which really kind of informed us at the Defense Committee that there was a support group located in Moscow. And I guess the turnout was okay, but what we thought was kind of interesting was that the person who had organized it said that even the Moscow police were really supportive of this rally and getting the true, honest information out on Peltier, and something like this is going on the other side of the world. But within the next 6th, 7th, and 8th of February, all over America, there are also these rallies and events going on. Most of our email, we get hundreds of emails every day, is people asking what they can do. And on the website, we have a link, what you can do. But upcoming this year, that's very important to us and very important to these cases, is that the Justice Department knows that we want fairness in this trial, because the first trial was anything but fair. And we also want these cases heard. There's a good chance they can let these ride for years to come. And we want to see these court cases go to court. And fairly.
That was Deborah Peebles of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. Contact the committee by calling area code 785-842-5774 or visit their website at www.freepeltier.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.